Okay, this evening's talk on Why Me Again. This is on the subject of rebirth. Now, many of you have heard this talk before in your past life. And now you're going to hear it again. And you'll hear it another time again if you get reborn again. So this is a talk on one of those wonderful aspects of Buddhism about many lives. The big picture, as I call it. Because sometimes when we only see one life, sometimes we only see part of one life. Sometimes when we only see one day of one life, then we're just seeing the small picture. When we extend this thing we call ourselves to spread not just from the time you were born to the time you will die, but beyond that and before that, then we get the big picture. It makes a different emphasis on the meaning of life. That is why that the understanding of rebirth is one of the great insights of Buddhism. You all may know, at least I think you should know, I hope you know, that the story of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree was one of practicing the meditation, attaining the jhanas. After attaining the jhanas, the next thing that evening was getting the insight into his past lives, next getting insight into the law of karma, and thirdly, insight into the Four Noble Truths, thereby becoming fully enlightened. These are the three great insights of a Buddha and of those great arahats, enlightened beings, who they say have got the te vijja, the threefold knowledge, threefold insight into past lives, karma, and the Four Noble Truths. So, all that we've been doing this week is insight meditation. And now I'm culminating this series of talks with one of the great insights, the insight into rebirth. Because sometimes people say, especially in Western countries, that they like Buddhism, but the part they can't understand, the part they can't accept is rebirth. They say that really, well, reincarnation or rebirth was just something which was added because it was part of the culture of India at the time. And it's not necessary, it's not essential to understanding Buddhism. Those people will have to come back again and learn Buddhism again because they failed the examination. It is part of Buddhism, an essential part of Buddhism, an integral part of Buddhism, because it's an essential part of truth. Anyone who has intelligence will be able to see that truth of rebirth. In fact, that idea of rebirth and reincarnation has been part of world culture for many, many millennia. It's interesting that being a Westerner and studying Western history, all the great Greek philosophers all believed in rebirth. Whether it was Socrates or Plato, whether it was Pythagoras, who you many know from his mathematical Pythagoras theorem, Heraclitus, all those Greek philosophers and sages all wrote about rebirth. And interesting, not just rebirth from human to human, but even rebirth from the animal realm to the human. One of the great, great Greek philosophers, this is 2,600 years ago, 700 years ago, Heraclitus, was recorded, who wrote down that he even remembered a previous birth as a fish. Now that's European culture. It was only later on in Christianity, and I think it was one of the councils of Nicaea in the 4th century, where there was a vote taken about whether to include reincarnation in the Christian teachings. Those who decided it should be included lost, and it was only a narrow vote, a majority vote, not unanimous. Which shows that it was even part of Western teachings in the beginning, and it was coming back to be part of Western teachings again now. The idea of rebirth, as they say, is making a comeback. Reincarnation is being reborn in the West. And we used to say, if you don't believe in reincarnation in this life, you certainly will in your next. So the point is that people, refined people, scientific people, rational people say, well, how can you know that there's a rebirth? How can you prove it for yourself? And sometimes people follow that teaching in Zen, which I disagree with. When somebody asked the Zen master, do you believe in rebirth? He said, no. How come you're supposed to be a Buddhist? How come you don't believe in reincarnation? And he said, because I haven't died yet. I don't know. However, I disagree with that. It was true that Zen master hadn't died in this life, but he had died only before, and he hadn't remembered it. You might have asked that Zen master, were you born? He should say no, because he can't remember it. Were you born? How many of you can remember when you were born? Most of you can't. Does that mean you were never born? The point is that our memory, in our early years, because of the lack of mindfulness, the lack of clarity, the lack of those neural pathways which make mindfulness possible in the early years, is not there, which is why we don't remember. But ask your mother, and she will say, she was there. She knows you were born. The point is, just because we can't remember our past lives does not mean they didn't exist. If what you can't remember doesn't exist, it means your babyhood doesn't exist. Memory is like that. However, there is ways and means of proving that rebirth happened. Ways and means of proving your rebirth. This is what I promised yesterday. Today I'm going to show you how you can find out for yourselves who you were before. There is a scientific experiment to prove that you had a life before this one. A scientific experiment is a method, a process, which can be repeated anywhere at any time to give the same results. That's what we call proof in science. An experiment which can be verified any time, any place. You know what that experiment is? It's called meditation. That experiment is not ordinary meditation. It's called the deep meditation which many of you yogis have been practicing here. Jhana meditation. The sort of meditation the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree. The way that he found out that he was born before and died before many times. Because this is one of the things you can do. Those yogis who've been meditating, those who have got some peaceful, blissful, powerful states, now I can tell you one way you can use those states to find out if you were born before and who you were before. I think it would be a wonderful thing if people could actually know who they were before. In Australia, we have this lady called Pauline Hanson. Many of you might remember her. She was quite a racist. She was anti-Asian. I would like her to do a meditation retreat so that she can get into such deep meditation that she can remember in her past life she was an Asian. Would she be a racist then? If all of those people who are men remembered they were women before, if the women remembered they were men, there wouldn't be all this messing around with who's a superior gender. Now, how do we do this? There comes a time in your meditation when you're very peaceful, you're very still, when your mindfulness is very, very strong. I've told you what strong mindfulness appears like. Strong mindfulness appears like huge energy in the mind. The mindfulness is so strong that whatever it looks at, it can see deeper into that than it's ever seen before. You have experiences like going outside of this hall and looking at the stars at night. And my goodness, those stars, they gleam, they're brilliant, as if they've been polished. you go and look at a leaf on a tree, and it captivates your attention for an hour. As you see so much beauty, so much detail, so much wonderful things inside that single leaf. In ordinary consciousness, in ordinary mindfulness, you just can't see that. Now your mind is bright, penetrating, full of energy. Those are signs that the mind is ready to do such things as remember past lives. If you've got that degree of stillness and energy, at the end of your meditation, before you come out, when you think now's the time to leave your meditation posture, what you should do is to suggest to yourself, very, very gently, what is my earliest memory? Just once is all you need. Clear, precise, simple. Because the mind in such a state, the Buddha said, is malleable, workable. It's like a well-trained servant. You give it clear orders and it will do exactly what you want. A lot of the time our mind isn't trained. It's like a servant or a maid who's just started a job. You ask it to do something, she doesn't know what to do. Or she messes it up. She can't follow orders. When you meditate to that degree, your mind is so still, so happy, so joyful. Whatever you tell it to do, it will usually follow those orders. What is my earliest memory? You ask. And then the mind comes up almost immediately with a memory of your past. Now I know that some people are wanting me to say, Ajahn Brahm, who were you in the past? Were you born in Penang before? Is that the why you come here so often? Were you really an Englishman or a Chinese man? Or were you a Thai? What were you in the past? Now, to stop all of this, I cannot say. I have rules which I have to keep, and I keep those rules very strictly. For those of you who want to find this out, you may look in the rules for monks. The 8th Paccitiya says that I cannot tell of my attainments. And one of those attainments is the memory of past lives. However, I do tell the memories of my early lives to give you an indication what happens. I can tell you what happens when you first start asking that question, what is my earliest memory? Because this is what happened to me. When I first did that, I was just in Australia. I was sitting in the hall, a nice meditation. Just for interest, I asked myself, what is my earliest memory? After only a space of a second or so, I was aware of a smell in my nose. It was a scent, a fragrance. With that appearance of the fragrance, straight away, I recalled that that was the smell of my baby's pram. And straight away, with that recognition, I was, as it were, in my meditation, back in my pram, as a baby, somewhere in London, some 30 or 40 years earlier. With that recognition came all the details of my baby's pram. Its colour, the canvas, black, the white, even the little pig, a little blue toy pig, which was on my pram, which was my favourite toy as a baby. I used to call it Porky, or rather my mother did, an obvious name, but I recalled how she used to walk it, and it rattled inside. The memories came flooding back, so clear, so full, and effortless. I was back in my baby's pram. This is what happens with an early life memory, or later a past life memory. What you recall quickly, in detail. And one of the most strange parts of an early life or past life memory is certainty. There's no doubt in your mind that that was you. Not an imagination, it's too real, it's too true, too recognizable to be a dream or a fantasy. If it happens to you, you know that was you. Interestingly also, that after that experience, I was surprised that it was the smell which was dominant at that time. Now, I never studied biology very much. I was into physics, chemistry, but I only did 1 year at biology at school because of the way the school curriculum was organized. But I asked the doctor, I mentioned that story to someone, the doctor came up afterwards, and they said that that's fascinating because when a baby is born, of all the five senses of smell, of sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch, it is the sense of smell which is dominant in a newborn baby. A baby recognizes its mother not by her sight, not by the sound of her voice, but by her mother's, by your mother's smell. You recognize your surroundings by smell. For a baby, almost like a dog or a cat, smell is dominant. That's what they said. Now I understand that. I know that's true. From experience. When you experience yourself back as a baby, you know how important smell actually is. And that's why that was the first sign of my babyhood. The smell of my baby's pram. Once you have that experience, you can enjoy those experiences, you can investigate as if you're right there, as if you can, by an effort of will, move around, see your pram, feel it, understand exactly what it's like. It's like another time when I remembered my primary school. In the first year as a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old going to school. Once you get that memory in these early life memories, you can literally walk around that school. Memories which you haven't had, which you'd forgotten 20, 30, 40 years earlier, you can recall with absolute clarity and perfection of detail. And everything is accurate. That's actually how it was at that time. Many other of my meditators in retreats have experimented with this. One of the meditators, she had a very interesting experience when she asked herself after a deep meditation, what is my earliest memory? Because she recalled herself as a baby in her mother's arms. She's only maybe 2 or 3 weeks old. A young baby. And she looked up into her mother's eyes, as you can do with these early life memories. You've got clear detail, and just through an act of, you know, will, just slightly asking the mind, look up. The mind looks up. And she was shocked. Because the woman holding her was not her mother. She could not recognize this person cradling her lovingly in her arms. It was such a shock to her that when she came out of the meditation, and she told me this in the interviews, she said she can't wait to go home after the meditation retreat is finished to confront her wife, her mother, and to ask her mother, are you really my mother? Is there something you haven't told me? What's actually happening? Because the woman who was lovingly holding her in her first weeks of life, was not the mother she knew as her mum. When the retreat finished, she actually went to her mother, her elderly mum, and said, Mum, are you really my mother? Is there something you haven't told me? Was I adopted? And her mother was shocked. What do you mean? Of course I'm your mother. Why do you ask such a question? And her daughter replied, explaining the experience she had in meditation. Her mother was inquisitive. What did that lady look like? Now, in these past life memories or early life memories, you have such clear recollection of detail, it's easy to explain what that woman looked like. So the daughter gave a very detailed description of that woman she saw holding her as a young baby. The mother couldn't believe this. The mother was very surprised. She said, I know that woman. I am your mother, she said. That was your nanny when you were freshly born, because they came from a very wealthy family. When you were newborn, we hired a nanny for you. That's a perfect description of her. You only had her for a few weeks. How you can remember that, I don't know. She remembered a nanny, a wet nurse,
her mother had hired for the first few weeks of her life, which she could never recall in any other way. These are just examples of what happens in those memories you get from deep meditation. They're fascinating. They're not things which you can imagine. You can't gain that information any other way. There's no pictures of her nanny at home. She was only 5 or 6 weeks when the nanny departed. This is a real memory. Accurate, true, not like ordinary memories. Because when these happen, it's as if you're right back there. It's happening, it's occurring. When you have some of these memories, you enjoy them, you investigate them to give you trust and faith that such a process is possible. Through meditation, you can enhance this power of the mind so much you can get these memories back. That gives you confidence and faith that this thing is not just a theory, but it's a reality. I think that somebody's car is in trouble, so please hold on. There's more about rebirth coming next. Would the owner, sorry for the interruption, there is a vehicle obstructing the traffic. Could the owner of vehicle PEQ8027 cancel? PEQ807, please remove your car or you'll be reincarnated somewhere else. PEQ8027. P for Peter, E for Edward, Q for question, 8027. Okay, obstructing traffic. Now, when you start getting these early life memories, then obviously the next thing you do will be to say, earlier, please. And your mind is just well trained. It will go and search for something even earlier. You might get, like some meditators have got, when you were coming out of your mother's womb. What an interesting experience that is. Because some people think that when you're born, you're not conscious. Now you know how it feels to be born. Beings who are born are conscious. Sometimes they're extremely conscious. Sometimes people, when they're freshly born, can speak. These are other stories which I like to tell people. Strange but true stories of babies having the ability to speak. I know two families in Perth to whom this happened. The first family came and told me once. These were an Australian family. They weren't Buddhists. I don't think they were Christians. They were just what most people in the West are these days, just nominal Christians, but they never go to church. But they had two children. One was called, I get the names wrong every time, so if you heard the story before, I might change the names, but it doesn't really affect the story. One was called Peter, the other one was called Jason. Two young boys, one was only freshly born, 1 or 2 weeks old. The other was a 2-year-old. Jason, I think, was the 2-year-old. It was Peter, I think. Peter was a newly born baby. One evening, when the parents were just watching the television or reading or doing some work or something, it was time for the older boy, Jason, to go to bed. So they told him, Jason, say goodnight to your baby brother and go to bed. So Jason went up to his baby brother, Peter, only 2 weeks old. And no, children being children, sometimes they don't do rational things. Jason leant over to the pram and said to his little baby brother, 2 weeks old, good night, Peter. And then Peter, the 2-week-old baby, said, good night, Jason. Now, if that happened to you, you can imagine what would occur. You think, did I hear that? Or am I imagining it? But the two of them heard it, the mother and the father. And they just turned around in complete disbelief at what they just heard. They never spoke to each other. They just stared in awe at what they thought they just heard. And their 2-year-old, without prompting, said again, good night, Peter. And this time with both parents paying full attention, fully mindful, alert, looking, investigating to see what's going to happen, saw their 2-week-old say, "Good night, Jason." And that worried them so much, they could hardly sleep. They couldn't wait to come to the Buddhist monastery to tell us about it. What the heck is going on? My baby is speaking. Babies aren't supposed to speak like that. But that one did. Of course, we told them, this sometimes happens. So sometimes that babies do speak when they're born, because they're coming from a previous life. They know language. They've been taught English, even before they've gone to school. Because it comes from their previous life. That family told us that after that experience, the baby didn't talk at all. Until the normal times when babies speak. And when it started speaking at the normal age for babies to start speaking, it was always in baby speak, like babies do. But when it spoke that first time, it wasn't like a baby speaks. It was an adult speak, with the way of pronunciation that an adult would say. Strange, but true. Another couple have said that. There's another person who did that as well, which you all know. A very famous man. The Buddha. When he was born, "I am the chief. I am the first. This is my last life." That's what the story says. When I was a young monk, I thought that was just added, you know, just superstition, because I was a rationalist Buddhist. Now I believe that was true. Have any of you heard your baby speak when it was one of... I say this because sometimes people put their hands up. They say, "Ajahn Brahm, this happened, but I never told anybody because I was afraid they would think I was crazy." If you had that experience, come up and tell me afterwards. I would add it to my repertoire of interesting stories. But perhaps the most interesting case was happened in the United States. When a baby spoke, when it came out of the womb in a maternity ward in a big hospital in the US, in front of the doctor doing the delivery, the midwives, the nurses, everyone standing around, as soon as the baby came out of the womb, it said in a clear voice, "Oh no, not again." That must have been a Buddhist. What a true story, but very interesting. "Oh no, not again." Because when you get reborn, as I've been telling people all week, you have to wear nappies again. You think you've done with nappies and that little thing they put in your mouth to shut you up. You think you've finished with school, don't you? No, 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 you've got to go back to school again and go through all of that business all over again, all that homework, all those exams. You're not finished until you're really finished, until you're out of samsara. Do you want to do that again? Be careful, otherwise you too will be born again and think, "Oh no, Ajahn Brahm was right, not again." You can remember that time when you were born, and you can understand why it is possible. Babies know what's happening when they come out of the womb. And some of them can actually say what it's like. Some people get earlier memories, what it's like inside the mother's womb. That's actually not that uncommon. Floating about in the waters warm of their mother's womb. That's why I think it's well known now that the babies in a womb are very conscious, very alert, very sensitive. There's one of my disciples in Perth. Her husband got a job in Saudi Arabia as some engineering. I think he's still there. She was, I think, a Malaysian Chinese Buddhist. But when she came to see me, she was pregnant with her first child. And she went over to Saudi Arabia, still pregnant. Being a woman in Saudi Arabia, you can't go to work. There's nothing much you can do. You have to be in home all day. So she took a whole load of my tapes and CDs, basically just to pass the time. So she listened to a lot of my talks while she was pregnant, waiting for a baby to be born in Saudi Arabia. Then her baby was born, there was no problem at all, but then she visited, a few weeks after her baby was born, she visited Australia. She came to see me to show me her new baby. Her baby was lying in her arms, and then I started speaking, and the baby looked up. I've heard that voice before, that baby thought. It was a common voice for that baby. That baby had heard the voice day after day after day. And that's why it looked for me. Babies in the womb are very alert. And you can know that because you were there before. If you get that memory, you know that yes, you were alert in your mother's womb. Now gets the interesting ones. Then you say, earlier please. And then the mind gives you a memory, presents a memory, which will really shock you. You remember another person, another time, even much older than you are now. You remember your past life. And just as before, you can remember this with all of the details. The name, the place, the area around. You know that that was you. With all of these memories, there always comes a certainty, which is a strange part of the past life memories. If anyone comes up to me and they say they had a sort of memory, but they're not really quite sure, I say, that's not the real one. The real thing, you don't have to ask me, you know that that was you. You know that you were in that home this afternoon before you came here, you visitors. You don't doubt that. The memory of a past life is even more certain than that. So strange, but that's what it's like. You know you were there at that time and that place many years ago. Unfortunately, that sometimes when people get their past life, they get the effect, or the event rather, which was closest to this life. Sometimes they get their death experience, which is one of the problems with past life memories. When they go back, the first thing they remember is, as you would probably expect, quite unpleasant, the last dying moments. Which is why that many meditators, when they do this, please be prepared for that. Sometimes you get something which is quite terrifying. You remember how you died. If that happens, please just ask earlier, please, earlier, please. So you go beyond that quite unpleasant experience. Otherwise, that some people get that experience of their past life death, and they recede away immediately. I don't want to do that ever again. It's like remembering what it's like to die. However, please do that because it's important that you know who you were before. Simply because it gives you that big picture. You don't have to doubt anymore that the Buddha's teachings of rebirth are true. You know from your personal experience that you've lived many times. And if you know that, that's going to change the way you look at life. For example, that once you've gone past that trauma of your previous death and gone into a little bit earlier, so you feel a bit more comfortable that you know that was you, you can investigate with a bit more ease. You will never be so afraid of death in this life. My goodness, you've done it before. It's just here we go again. When you've done something before, you become more familiar with it. When you become more familiar with it, you can relax a bit more. The first time you drive a car, sometimes you're terrified. After many, many times of driving, you know what to do. If you can only remember how many times you've died, now you might remember what to do, to relax and let it happen, instead of struggling all the time, just like in your meditation. There's lots of advantages to that, to remembering your past lives. That's just one of them. You can actually die more peacefully. You don't get upset other people dying. Because you know that they're not going to be taken away from you forever. This is just part of the coming and going in samsara. It's fascinating that so often people get reborn together, like families, like clans, stick together, not just through thick and thin, but they stick together through life and death and more life. It's like our attachments to each other are just so strong that we pull each other, as it were, together, like as a flock, like as a band, like as a shoal of fish, going from life to life. So often it happens that the persons, your husband or your wife, were part of your family before. Your children were your parents. Your cousins were your best friends. So often we meet each other many, many times. People who remember their past lives tell me this, and it's fascinating just how often it is that we get reborn into the same family. Because we still love these people. We want to be back there with them. One of my disciples in Perth is a Thai girl. This Thai lady, she remembered her past life when she was born, spontaneously, without need of any meditation. Some people can do this. She was born in a village in Thailand, a remote village, a traditional village. She was born, let's say, in her last life. The previous life she remembered, that she died quite young, only about 30s or 40s. Her son from a previous life was very smart, went to school, got a scholarship, went to university, and came back to the village as the headmaster of the school. Now, in those days, village schools, there would just be basically one class, you know, almost for every child. And the schools were very, very strong discipline. Now, even stronger than in Malaysia. When the teacher came in, everyone stood up. They did exactly what the teacher said. If anybody misbehaved, they get the cane straight away. They're very, very strict schools. Now, her son from the past life became the headmaster of this school. She got reborn as the headmaster's niece. Same family, same village. When she was reborn as the headmaster's niece, she recalled the past life so clearly, with all the details, story after story after story, that everybody in that village had no doubt at all that that was the headmaster's mother from the previous life. Even the headmaster accepted that. His niece now was his mother in his earlier life. So, when this little girl, the headmaster's niece, went to school for the first time, when the headmaster walked into the classroom, all the children stood up, but she didn't stand up. She kept sitting down, she told me. How could she stand up for her son? Her son should stand up for her. And the headmaster saw this little girl sitting down. He knew that was his mother. How can you cane your mother? He just couldn't do it. So she told me she had a great time at school. Of all the children there, she was the only one who could do what she liked whenever she wanted. Because the headmaster could not discipline his mother. She just could not do it. So she didn't learn very much, but she had a great time. And this is one of the problems when we remember our rebirth. How can you punish your mum? You just can't do that. There's another story of rebirth. This is an Australian story. It's one of the Buddhists, and it also introduces the law of karma as well. Fascinating story. There's one of the Buddhists in Sydney, one of the strong Buddhists there. He's been a Buddhist for many years, an Australian, Westerner. He was the only Buddhist in the family. His auntie was a very successful business lady. I think she was a spinster. She never got married. But my goodness, she was ruthless in business. And she soon became a multi-millionaireess. She was rich. She lived in a big mansion somewhere in Sydney. Now, when it was there was two things his auntie, hated in life. One was religion. She just did not like any religion at all. She thought they were just a lot of stupidity, didn't make any sense. And they just lived on charity when they should probably get a proper job themselves, all these priests and monks. She was one of these people, hard-nosed business lady, who didn't believe in religion at all. The second thing she hated was paying taxes. She'd do anything to avoid paying taxes to the government. She'd get lawyers, she'd defer her payments, she'd try and argue about her tax return, anything to get out of paying taxes. The two things she hated in life were religion and taxes. Now, when she did her will, when she was close to dying, she thought how she would distribute her property, her wealth, to her family.
when it came to her nephew, this Buddhist, the only Buddhist in the family, she thought, if I give him any money, he'd only give it to the temples, the Buddhist temples. I'm not going to have that. So of all the family, he just got such a small amount, hardly anything, just a pittance compared to anyone else, simply because of a hatred of religion. But there was a karmic consequence to that, because when she died, a few months later, her nephew's wife became pregnant. When this man, this city man, the nephew of this aunt, when his first daughter was born, when all the family came around to see the new daughter in their family, everyone remarked, "Oh, doesn't that look like your auntie?" Even facially, it bore a strong resemblance to this rich woman who just died. When that baby started speaking, it became quite clear to everyone that the resemblance wasn't just physical. That was the auntie reborn. She remembered so much of her previous life. This fellow told me that he was walking into the room one day with a cup of coffee. Just an ordinary cup. That's what he'd inherited from his mother. Just the ordinary kitchenware they used every day. The expensive stuff went to somebody else. As soon as he came in with a cup of coffee, his daughter went berserk. "My cup, Daddy, give me my cup back. That's my cup. You've got my cup." When they went anywhere near where her mansion was, "Daddy, my mansion, take me to my mansion." Her memories of her past life were flooding back. No one was in any doubt that his daughter was his aunt reincarnated. Now the interesting part of this, because she did not like doing any merit, any good karma to religion, that's why she didn't give anything to her future father. That's why she had to grow up in poverty. If she'd have been more generous and more fair and given some more money to her future father, she wouldn't have been so hard up as a young girl. So remember, do not hate religion. It will come back to you. Second interesting point, he told me that one day when his daughter was very young, because he's a Buddhist, he actually called his daughter Dana, generosity. That was her first name. I won't tell you what the rest of the name was. When his little daughter, when actually they were going on a trip somewhere along one of the tollways around Sydney, they passed a billboard, one of these big signs on the side of the road. On the sign was the words TAX. It was something to do with the government. And this little two-year-old said, "Daddy, what does the word tax mean?" It's fascinating that a little girl would be even interested in asking what that word means. And so Daddy tried to explain, now to a two-year-old, the concept of tax. And what he said was, "Now darling, if I give you any pocket money, it's about you have to give some of that to the government. You have to share it with the government." And straight away, the little daughter not only understood, but said with a scowl, "Daddy, when you give me any pocket money, I'm giving nothing to no government." Her hatred of governments was still there as a two-year-old in her next life. Character traits pass over. The actual knowledge of exactly why don't pass over. If you're a generous person in this life, you find you have a natural generosity you want to share in your next life. If you're mean, stingy, you find you're mean and stingy in your next life. You don't know why, but these character traits pass over, just as they pass over from year to year, from day to day. You wake up basically not quite the same person, but recognizable in your character traits. And those are examples of the character traits of hating government taxes and religion. This is what happens. This is why those things happen, why some people are like that. We often meet each other in the same family. That's why so often
We recognize each other. Don't you? Haven't you recognized the person in your life? Very often it's the person you fall in love with. Why is it, you wives, you husbands, why did you fall in love and marry that girl, that man, rather than anyone else? It's often because you recognize that you've known them before, that they have been a partner or a close friend in a previous time. Certainly that's what love at first sight is. Love at first sight is instant recognition. It's not first sight. You've known them before. You recognize each other. Not in explicitly, but implicitly. That's what happens. Sometimes, though, it's hate at first sight. There's some people you sometimes meet for no reason. You just, oh, you feel so uncomfortable in their presence. You feel so horrible. You want to get out of the room straight away, and they can be a good person. Why is that? It's also a memory of a past life. Sometimes that person has hurt you or harmed you before. You can't know why, but you just don't want to be there anymore. That's hate at first sight. So often this explains a lot about our emotional impact on each other. There was one of the founding Buddhists in England. Many of you may know him. He wrote books a long time ago, Christmas Humphreys. He was once interviewed on BBC Radio. At this time, he was a judge. He was one of the pillars of society in London, very well known, and supposed to be, as a judge, very honest, upright, and forthright. So he was interviewed on the BBC about his Buddhist beliefs. And the interviewer asked him, as a Buddhist, do you believe in reincarnation? Because most people, you know, rationalists, say, no, you can't have reincarnation, they didn't believe in it. The BBC were trying to put him on the spot. He said, I don't believe in reincarnation, I know reincarnation, I remember my past lives. And they said, come on. He said, no, and he remembered. What he said was very interesting. He said he remembered his wife from the previous life when he first met her in this one. He knew straight away he'd be married to that woman. But, fascinating, he knew that the karma from the past meant that he didn't need to marry her in this life. They remained the best of friends, close friends in this life. But he married another lady, even though, as it were, he had two wives, one from this life and one from the past. His one from the past was just a close friend, and his wife from this life obviously understood and accepted that. Fascinating that you can meet your ex-wife, your ex-husband, but feel such a bond of friendship, but no need to get married anymore. This is what I was saying, that we can meet each other, but not in the same way. Maybe your son becomes your father. Maybe your sister becomes your brother. People we're close to. Sometimes siblings, brothers and sisters, are extraordinarily close. Very often it's because they were man or wife in previous existences. Rebirth makes so much sense. It tells us the why, what's happening. But sometimes people complain, they say, look, rebirth, reincarnation can make no sense at all because there's more human beings alive today than have probably ever been dead. We're reproducing that fast. Population explosion. Where have all the human beings come from? And it's obvious that there's a very clear answer to that. Human beings, they don't just get reborn into human beings or come from human beings. As the Buddha said, and as even the Greek philosophers said, that people get reborn from the many realms, not just human to human, from the lower realms, animal realms, human realms, deva realms. We get reborn from place to place. In the present time, in our present last 20, 30 years, the number of animals, the animal realm, has decreased in numbers extraordinarily. as the human realm was increased extraordinarily. Where do you think most people have come from their past life? The animal kingdom. And that explains much of their behavior. It's as if, even though the Buddha said that, you know, in those times, like getting a human rebirth was like the turtle swimming in the ocean, and a yolk, this like circle with a hole in the middle, sort of also floating in the ocean. And the random chance of the turtle, without global positioning, managing to surface and poke its head through that yolk, it is so unlikely. He said, that's how unlikely a human birth is. But in those days, it's like applying for a job when there's not many openings. These days, there's huge number of openings for human births because our human population is exploding. That's why it's becoming easier to get a human birth, because there's an increase in opportunities. People are having babies. Now, one of the examples of this, one of the stories of an animal being reborn as a human, came from one of the monasteries in Thailand, which we know very well. In Thai monasteries, as you probably know, it's sanctuary for animals. Sometimes people have cats they can't look after, and they just leave them in the monasteries for the monks to look after. They have dogs. Sometimes they just dump them in the middle of the night because they've got no other place to look after them, and they think, well, the monks or the nuns are so kind, they'll look after them. Please don't do that. But however, in this one monastery, it wasn't just cats and dogs. Someone had a monkey they couldn't look after. Actually, I think they found it. Someone else was mistreating it in a cage. And so they decided to take it to the monastery and release it in this forest monastery in the northeast of Thailand. The abbot was a very, very kind monk. This was a practicing monastery, a very, very good monastery. And so this monkey, because of the kindness of the abbot and all the monks, soon settled down and became one of the members of the monastery. Literally, whenever it was tea time in the afternoon, they had to make a mug of tea for the monkey. And the monkey would sit there with all the other monks, holding the cup of tea. There was only an EY difference between the monkey and the monks. And they, I don't know if I should say this anyway, they even made it a pair of shorts to stop it playing with itself in public. This little monkey. This monkey was very, very protective of the monastery. And it obviously considered itself to being like a human being, like being a monk. It identified with the monks. The monks were its friends, its tribe, as it were. So when this monkey heard any cars or trucks outside the monastery, it would chase it to try and protect the silence of the monastery. The abbot couldn't stop it doing this, and one day the monkey chased the truck and got run over and killed. That's how the monkey died. Now this monk who's in charge of the abbot was he is a powerful meditator. In his meditation, he saw that monkey die, and he saw its stream of consciousness leave the body and go off into the village and enter the womb of a pregnant woman. He saw that baby take rebirth. When that baby was born, it was unusually hairy. It was a son, it was a boy, a very hairy boy. Now, I don't know what's happened since, because it's a long time since I was at that monastery, but I'm sure that all the village know that little boy's previous life, and he's going to get into a lot of trouble at school when they say what he was in the previous life. You were a monkey before, and you're a monkey now. He was a monkey being reborn. Often that happens from the animal realm to the human realm. It's not that much of a difference. Genetically, the difference between a monkey and a human is very, very small. Animals have intelligence. Animals have emotions. Animals can cry. Cows can cry. There's not that much difference between a human being and the higher animals, which is why we can get reborn from one to the other. Never think that animals are so different than us. The story I tell of the cow that cried is a fascinating story and true. In this particular story, it happened at the prison I used to go and visit. Not far from our monastery in Australia, only 8 kilometers up the road, there is a prison farm. It's like an open prison for prisoners whose crimes are not that severe, or for prisoners who are at the end of their sentence and who are trying to be rehabilitated gradually back into ordinary life. So there's not much security in this prison. It's a farm. The idea of the government was to teach the prisoners a trade so that when they leave they could join some farm somewhere in Australia, get a job, and so not reoffend. Every prisoner had to have a job on that farm. Now this was an Australian farm. Australian farms, they do grow a few veggies, maybe some wheat, but the main thing they grow in Australian farms is animals. Cows, pigs, sheep. Now, I must say this West Australian government was stupid, because in this prison farm, they also had a slaughterhouse. They slaughtered these animals in the farm, and they got the prisoners to do the slaughtering. Now, what are you training the prisoners to do when they leave jail, if you get them to do a job like that? These were already violent men. Now you're just encouraging them in their violence. I thought that's a stupid thing to do. But one day, before I was going to teach my meditation class, this big Irish prisoner was waiting for me. He said, "Can I talk to you before the class? I've been waiting for you. Something happened the last few days, and I want you to know about it." Now he was huge. One of these big Irishmen who was built like a tank. Wide shoulders, bushy hair, a big beard, scars all over him, tattoos. The sort of person, if you met, my goodness, you'd be afraid. And I was a bit afraid at first. When I saw him, I said, "You must have come to the wrong place. This is meditation." I didn't expect tough guys to want to meditate. And he was a tough guy. He told me his story. He said he was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And you all know what a violent city that is. The center of the conflict between the Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland is in Belfast. He said, to show me his upbringing, that he was first stabbed when he was 7 years of age. He said he was in the school playground. The school bully came up to him to ask for the money he had for his lunch. "Give me your dinner money or I'll stab you," said the boy. The 7-year-old thought this was just a bluff. So he said no. And the boy never asked a second time. Just got out a long sharp knife and stabbed the 7-year-old in the arm. And the boy was more surprised than in pain. With blood streaming down his arm, he ran out of the playground to his father's house, which was very close by. His father, like many like him, was unemployed, would never get a job. Staying at home, they were very poor. When he went in to see his father, "Dad, I've been stabbed, I've been stabbed." His father took him into the kitchen, but not to dress the wound. The father just took out another knife, gave it to his 7-year-old son, and ordered him to go and stab that boy back. He said that's how he was brought up. He confided in me that he'd been very violent, he'd actually killed people. He was a murderer. But he was not in jail for murder this time. He didn't tell me the crime he was in jail for, but he told me that he was the person who had the most sought after job in the whole prison. The job which prisoners had to fight for to get. It was the slaughterer in the slaughterhouse. The one who actually killed the cows, the sheep, or the pigs. He had to fight for that job. Only the toughest of prisoners would get it. And he'd been that slaughterer for many, many months. He told me what the slaughterhouse was like. It was out of bounds for visitors like me. He said, in this building, there were stainless steel rails at the entrance, starting off very wide and narrowing down like a funnel to the entrance. The idea was you had to herd the animals in until they came one by one into this building. Just in the entrance of the building was a platform on which he would stand. He would have an electric gun, which had a powerful enough charge would kill the biggest of bulls, but no animal would ever stand still enough to aim properly. Once the animals were in, it would always be one shot anywhere around the head to stun it. And the next shot, when the animal was stunned and still, he could aim properly, the second to kill. He'd been killing animals for months. Now pigs, now cows, now sheep, whatever the prison service wanted. He enjoyed the job. But he said the day which changed his life was when they were needing beef, steaks, for their prison service. They were killing cows. They had to prod these cows with electric prods to move them through, because those cows knew what was going to happen to them. They could smell death, they could hear death, they could feel it. All the cows, the sheep, whatever it was they were killing, he said, would always try and escape if they could. And they said they would scream in their own ways. Not the sounds you'd hear of animals in the pasture, but the moans and wails of animals knowing they were about to be executed. They would scream, they would wriggle, they would writhe. They would never stay still. They need to be prodded with electric prods or dogs to move through. And there was always one shot to stun, the second to kill, one after the other. On this day, which had changed his life, only two or three days before he came to see me, he said, one cow came between those rails beneath his platform, like no other cow he'd ever seen. That cow came silently, making not the slightest of noise, with its head down, not trying to escape, walking what we would call mindfully, carefully, resolutely, one foot after the other, until it was positioned voluntarily between those two railings, beneath the executioner. Silently, slowly, the cow moved up its head, turned it round, and looked at the prisoner, eye to eye. This criminal, this murderer, told me he'd never seen anything like this in his life. A being about to die, showing no fear, but just staring at the one who's about to kill it. He couldn't bring himself to pull the trigger, even though just one shot, the cow being so still, would kill it. The cow was keeping eye contact with this man. He said he didn't know how many seconds or minutes passed by, but he noticed something strange in one of the cow's eyes. I think you all know a cow, and how big its eyes are. They are 3 or 4 or 5 times bigger than a human eye. They're huge. He noticed in one of the cow's eyes, above its lower eyelid, water start to build up. The water built up more and more. The longer he looked, the more it gathered above the lower eyelid of one of the cow's eyes, until the water was too much for the lid to contain, and it started to trickle over the lower eyelid and down the cow's cheek. That cow was crying. He'd never seen
anything like that, nor imagine such a thing could exist. He said he lost it completely. He didn't know what he was doing. He was in space, confusion, not knowing where he was or what to do. Time stood still when he noticed the same thing happened in the other eye. Water built up more and more until that eye could not contain the water anymore, and another silver streak of tears dribbled down the other cheek of the cow. That broke the murderer. He threw down his gun. He swore as only prisoners know how. The meaning of his swear words were, "That cow is not dying." He said the prison officers can do anything they like with him, but that cow ain't dying. When he came to see me, he said, for the last 2 days, and forever after, he is a vegetarian. That was the story of the cow that cried, which changed the murderer, one of the roughest people I've ever met, into a vegetarian. It's not that different from being a cow about to be murdered than being a human being about to lose their life. Don't think that human beings and animals are so different. We are very, very similar. That's why we can be reborn from one stage to another, from animals to humans, humans to animals. That's why we are kind to animals. That animal could be your father, your grandmother from your past life. Be careful. So, when we understand rebirth, you can see with the insight of real knowledge, you can see just how it does affect our lives, how it changes our ideas of morality, how it changes the way we look at things, how it gives us a different meaning to this thing we call life and death. Human beings, animals, different races, different religions. My goodness, we have been brothers and sisters in the past. How can you go to war with your mum, with your dad? They may have been born in a different country, a different race, different religion, different gender. But they're your relations. They're your ancestors, they're your friends. If only we remembered rebirth, if only we remembered just where we were before, I think there'd be much more peace in this world. We just couldn't fight other beings. We couldn't even kill a cow, let alone go to war with some other country, some other race, some other religion. So the truth of rebirth is there for you to find out. There's many other stories of rebirth of people who spontaneously remember their past lives. I've already told one. One of the other stories I will tell of rebirth, which is fascinating, because it shows again how your character, how your talents actually pass from one life to another. One of the famous stories of rebirth concerns an English comedian. He was not the most popular comedian, but certainly in England he was a household name. A fellow, some of you might know him, a fellow called Roy Hudd. Roy Hudd, if anyone knows him, I knew him as in the 60s, 70s, 80s on English TV. He was a well-known comedian at the time. Maybe not internationally known, but certainly known in London, in all over England. He wrote an article once about a fascinating experience he had. He got lost in London once, even though it was his hometown. He went down a wrong street, never been in that area before, turned down another street. When he went down a road, he said just shivers went up and down his spine. Because he knew straight away that in another time and place he'd lived in that street. He went straight for the house where he used to live in his past life. The memories, the shock of actually visiting a place you've lived in before, jogged his memories so profoundly, memories came flooding back. He remembered his previous life.
In his previous life, he was probably even more well known, because, as many of you know if you visited London, if anyone famous has lived in one of those houses, they put a blue metal sign on that house saying who lived there. If Winston Churchill lived somewhere, they put Winston Churchill lived here, 1911 to 1920 or something. This house had one such name on it. Now, you may not know this name because maybe you don't know English history, but there was a very famous, probably the most famous music hall star of that time was a person called Dan Leno. You can actually look it up if you like the history of show business. Dan Leno was one of the most popular music hall stars. That was his house. This comedian, TV personality, Roy Hudd, was Dan Leno in his past life. He just knocked on the door, and the people recognized him straight away as, you know, TV personality, what do you want? He said, this was my house before, I was Dan Leno. And he took the residents all around the house. He'd never been in the house before in this life. He recalled it from his previous life. He was a comedian before. He was a comedian again. Maybe that was my past life, a comedian. So, who knows what you were in the past? But you can find out. That's the main thing. Some people have those spontaneous memories. Something strong jogs it, and you find out. But if you want a more sure way, get into one of these meditation retreats. Follow the instructions. And if you follow those instructions, you get deep meditation, ask, what is my earliest memory? Then you too may find out who you were in the past. And it's fascinating to know. Then you know for yourselves, one of the Tevijas, one of the three knowledges which the Buddha praised, the knowledge of your previous life. That is insight which will change your life. Thank you. Any questions on that? Hands up anyone who can remember their past life. No? Oh, okay. Maybe you can come and tell me afterwards. Because sometimes people are a bit, either not ashamed, but they're reticent to make such claims in public. Here we go. Okay, another question. So it's question time now. Remember that I've got another day I'm giving talk, so if you want to put questions on a piece of paper, you can, and I'll answer it after the main topic of the talk. So who knows what I'm going to talk about next, in the next 45 minutes or an hour, because this is question time. Okay, can past memories be recalled not only by meditation but also by hypnotism? What is the difference? Yeah, it does seem that you can recall past memories by hypnotism, but it's less certain. Because sometimes people get false memories by hypnotism. I remember seeing one program on a television, because people recorded it for me and showed it to me. We're not allowed to watch television, but if there's a documentary which is important, people sometimes record it and they show it. And this was a documentary on reincarnation. It was an experiment done by a hypnotist in Sydney. What he did, he was regressing many of his patients who had some psychological or social problems, and using past life memories to try and explain why. But he came across a lot of people who recall past lives, and the interesting thing about this particular therapist was that some of these people who claim past lives had been born in Australia and lived in Australia all their life. And they were recalling past life memories in Europe. And it was impossible that they could have gained those detailed memories having lived and grown up in Europe. Being an island and being a place where you can check with a passport agency whether this person had ever left, they could find out for sure that person could never have been to that place in this life. So that gave them an advantage. And this therapist talked a TV company, Channel 7, in Australia, to putting up the money to send these four people to these places in Europe where they said they lived before, and try and dig up as much information and also see what it was like when they visited for the very first time places they said they lived before.
It's a fascinating documentary. Although the four people they chose were actually women, because they had the clearest memories, memories which should be authenticated. For me, the most convincing case was a woman in Sydney, born and bred in Sydney, who remembered her previous life as a male, as a doctor in Scotland in the 1850s. The town she remembered was called Blairgowrie. As a young man, I went up and down Scotland. I never heard of a town called Blairgowrie, but there is such a town. She remembered her name, Dr. James Archibald Burns. James is a common name. Burns is a very common name. Archibald, maybe not so common. But if you could find, the only one doctor in the 1850s, if you could find the name of the doctor, the one doctor in Blairgowrie in Scotland in the 1850s, and find that his name was James Archibald Burns, would that be convincing? Of course, they did that in the local library. James Archibald Burns was the well-known doctor at the time. Not only that, but gave all the information about the medical school in Aberdeen, where as young James Archibald Burns he'd done his medical degree. And they found another person, one person, an eccentric Scotsman, whose hobby was the architecture of this medical school. English people have got some strange hobbies, but it was very helpful, because this was the only guy who knew what that medical school looked like in the 1850s. She was asked to draw plans of it in Sydney, without any knowledge of it even being there. He checked those plans with the originals. They were perfect. The memory was just so amazingly accurate. It was certainly convincing to me that under hypnosis, that lady from Sydney was recalling her previous life as James Archibald Burns, the doctor in the town of Blairgowrie in Scotland. Sometimes the hypnotists just strike gold, and you do get an accurate description of a previous life. But not always. The difference between hypnotism, you are letting go, just like you're doing in meditation, but your whole mindfulness is disappearing, and you're relying on the mindfulness, on the power of the hypnotist to tell you what to do. Sometimes the hypnotist can put in suggestions, and I think that's why sometimes the memories aren't accurate. Now, meditation memories are always accurate. Hypnotists sometimes are, sometimes not. So that's the difference there. Next question. Is there such a thing as soulmates? How do we know whether we have found the same partner from our previous lives? Will the same loving couple of today be together in the next life? We mentioned there that sometimes you might meet together, but you don't want to get married again this time. Even though you had a very loving relationship, you want to be the best of friends. The relationship goes on a different way. So that relationship is impermanent. It changes. It evolves. So someone you're very close to this life, you become friends the next life, but you know you've done with the being married. Sometimes it might be a close friend you marry them the next life. Or there may be your son, your daughter in the next life. That's how it goes. How you know whether you've found the same partner from the previous lives? You don't really know. If you do some meditation and follow the advice, maybe you might find out who that guy you married really was. But sometimes people get a bit crazy. There was one monk once told me that he was visiting the island of Malta, and this lady came up to him and said, "Ah, it's you again. I was married to you in your previous life. My karma is to get married to you again in this life." "Ah," said the monk, and he ran out the room. She was only a bit crazy, that's all. The goddess of mercy plays a prominent role in Mahayana Buddhism, but not in Theravada Buddhism. Please enlighten us on this. Okay. The goddess of mercy, Kuan Yin, like in Buddhism, even like the Buddha, we like to see what the Buddha represents, what the symbol is. And in Theravada Buddhism, the symbol, what it represents, is more important than the person. So I said the other day, you bow not to a statue of the Buddha, you bow to what the Buddha represents. So in Theravada, we'd worship what the goddess of mercy represents, compassion. It's a symbol of
unconditional loving kindness. When we look upon it as a symbol, then we worship the symbol, not the thing in itself. So there's many other symbols of compassion which we have in the world. Whatever is compassionate, that we can worship. Because by worshipping it, we tend to imitate the qualities of the thing we worship. So I said the other day, all the teenage girls who worship Madonna tend to dress like her and even speak like her. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we worship the Buddha and then we dress like the Buddha, like I do? And you might even learn to speak like the Buddha. So that's why we worship, to imitate. So if you worship Kuan Yin, great, but make sure that worship is worshipping not the person, not the being, but what it represents. Compassion. Mercy. Recently, a 52-year-old woman and her 13-year-old son were killed in an accident when they stopped to help a motorcyclist in trouble. This is just one example of a good Samaritan where a good deed ended in tragedy. This gives the impression that if not necessary, that good begets good. Can Ajahn comment on this? Okay, there's many other people who stopped to help motorcyclists who didn't get killed. In fact, the vast majority of people who stop and help actually feel very good about it. You get good friends. There was a man who, he went to this little lookout, this viewpoint, just opposite our monastery. And while he was there walking his dog, he tripped over and hit his head. And his wife was panicking, and so she went to the nearest place, our monastery. So we went out to help him. He wasn't badly injured, but there's a lot of blood. You know what happens when there's an injury? There's lots of blood, and it looks much worse than it actually is. So we took him in our monastery car to the local hospital. He got patched up, spent overnight in the hospital, and now he's one of our devotees. He literally fell for our monastery. And he said it was one of the most wonderful experiences of his life to have that accident just outside the Buddhist monastery. He was an Englishman from Yorkshire. And there was an occasion when we went to help somebody. Nothing bad happened to us. But the thing is, when nothing bad happens, when you go and help, that doesn't get in the newspapers. No one ever talks about that. It is the anomalies, the things which seem a bit strange, they're the ones which people talk about. So if you actually look at the big picture, the full picture, whenever you go and help someone, usually only good comes out of it. It's very, 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 very rare that somebody does something good and something like this happens. Usually what is happening, it's a mixture of good karma and bad karma. There's some bad karma there was about to happen anyway, and it just happened just before they did some good. That good was an opportunity to make sure that bad karma of dying meant they didn't go to a bad place. They've done something good just before they died, so they're bound to have a good rebirth. So this is actually the answer to that question. Good nearly always begets good. The trouble is that we don't hear about those actions. Does that make sense? Okay, next question. Can you please explain the concept of rebirth, reincarnation and deja vu with respect to our ordinary lives? Yeah, sometimes you actually do go places. Especially if it's old places, like you go to these ancient places, like old castles, old mansions. And you go to the old places and then something, you feel you've been there before. Just like that story of Roy Hudd. He had that deja vu when he went down that street by mistake getting lost. And he knew straight away that deja vu was where he'd lived before. Sometimes you get that. But if you get a deja vu on a new house which has only been built 5 years ago, you realize that cannot be a past life memory. That's something else completely. So yeah, sometimes the deja vu of an old place, it may be an old temple somewhere, an old building. If you get a deja vu there, you feel you've been there before. You know all about it. Yeah, it is because you've lived there before. I don't quite agree with your statement, forgive but not forget. Isn't that mean that we are not really forgiving? I still find it not very sincere because we still keep a distance from him, her, who hurt us before, and the relationship won't be as good as before. Please correct my wrong view. Thank you, Ajahn.
Okay, the forgive but not forget. What I mean by not forget is you forget the pain, the hurt, but you don't forget the experience. It's learning experience. All the painful experiences which I've experienced in life, I remember because I don't want to repeat them. If you keep forgetting it, you become stupid because you keep making the same mistakes again. So you don't forget it, you don't forget the lesson, but you learn from it. Did I tell the story? I did tell the story of the five horses, didn't I? Did I tell the five types of horses in Buddhism? That might be a morning talk. Yeah, no, it was an afternoon talk as well. Okay, so this is how we're not stupid. We learn from our mistakes. We learn only once. We don't have to keep repeating the mistake again. So what I meant by we forgive, but we don't forget, means we remember the experience, but with no hatred, with no feeling of revenge or remorse. Remember what was done. We learn from those experiences. I remember those experiences because I use those experiences as material for my talks. I don't forget the stupid things I've done, like leaving the hammer in the forest, I said the other day. I don't forget the bad things done to me because I tell other people about them. I think I already told you about the person, the ladies, the school, who said, "We remember you, Ajahn Brahm," didn't they? Okay, I went to give a talk at a school, a girls' school in Perth, an expensive girls' school. I was talking to them about Buddhist culture. Two days later, I was walking down one of the streets of Perth on some business when these girls came up to me, these schoolgirls, and they said, "Hello, you were the monk who came to give a talk at our school a couple of days ago." And I said, "I'm actually quite surprised and flattered you remember me." And the girl said, "Oh, we wouldn't forget you. We'll never forget you. How can you forget someone called Ajahn Brah?" I said, "There's an M on the end. It's not Brah, it's Brahm." They were just trying to upset me, trying to tease me like young girls sometimes do. But I forgave them straight away and I laughed as well. But I never forgot that story because I've used that very often. It was like another time. Excuse me. There's another time in Perth. We're going along one of these very, very wide highways, three lanes going in both directions. And as we were driving along, it wasn't a very busy day, we saw these young men, maybe 17, 18, just driving a car for the first time, out for a good time. They saw myself and a couple of other monks in the car. They decided to have some fun, because monks were weird and monks were strange. So sometimes people shout out abuse at you. Sometimes they try and tease you. These young men were a bit more resourceful. On the three-lane highway, they came right next to me at the traffic lights. They opened their window and they called for my attention. I was in the front passenger seat. And my window was down as well because it was a hot day. So I looked around to see what they wanted to do. They got out a magazine and pointed to it. "Hey, look! Playboy." They were really teasing me. But I didn't look. I didn't look. So someone asked me, said, "How do you know it was Playboy then?" The driver told me. So they're just teasing. So again, when people do that, you forgive them straight away. There's only young men having a joke. I would have done the same if I was young and saw a monk, probably. You're just teasing, having a bit of fun. But I don't forget that experience, because I can always make use of it in my life. So that's what I mean. You forgive, you learn, you don't forget it, if it's useful for you. You keep it as one of your experiences in life to learn from. So that's what I say. I make use of all the experiences I've had in life to learn, but I don't forget if they're valuable experiences. I hope that makes sense. But we forgive. We forget the hurt. We don't forget the lesson. Next question, how many insights we've got to go through to become liberated? One. Does each of us come across the same insights? No. Sometimes people go around the long way, left and right, all over the place. But sometimes you only need that one insight, the big insight, to become enlightened. You all want to know what it is, don't you? It's usually the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Emptiness, nothingness, anatta, cessation. That's the insight. What is the difference between heart and mind? Pleasant and unpleasant feeling, love, anger, ill will seem to arise from the heart. I feel these sensations in my heart when I heard a sudden sound during meditation. It seemed to strike through my heart. Are both the heart and mind the same thing? Do we think with our mind or our heart? Okay. I've already mentioned what your mind is. Where is your mind? It's not in your body. It's not in your head. Your heart is in your mind. So is your body. So is the world. The mind is the biggest thing in the world. Remember that story I said? The little child, 5 years old, asked by the teacher, what's the biggest thing in the world? Now the eye is the biggest thing in the world, because the eye can see, each one of you can see mountains, can see planets, can see stars. If all of that can fit in your eye, it must be the biggest thing in the world. The logic of a 5 year old, which is brilliant. Your mind can see everything, can hear everything, can feel everything, can think everything. Everything that can be known can fit into your mind. So, your mind is the biggest thing in the whole world, according to that reason. So, your heart is in your mind, not your mind in your heart. But sometimes we associate certain feelings with certain places. Sometimes I used to, in the West, they used to associate anger with bile. They say you're bilious. And the bile is like a liquid secreted from, what is it, the gallbladder or something? And they say that that's where you feel anger. But really, it's up to us, because sometimes when people in the West, they ask them, now how are you feeling? They always point to their head. In Asia, they point to their heart. It really doesn't matter, because your heart is in your mind. If your heart was the mind, when you had a heart transplant, who would you be? Would you be the person who had the previous heart? It's only a matter of time before someone has a brain transplant. Suppose, I already said yesterday, I'm an organ donor. Suppose that you needed a brain, and I died, and you got my brain. Would you tell jokes like Ajahn Brahm? Would you have to be a monk? Who would you be if you got my brain? Would you be like the rest of your body? Or would you be like my brain? You'd be just like the rest of your body, just like the heart. You wouldn't be me at all. I'd be gone. So the brain is not the person, nor is the heart. Dear Ajahn, is rebirth a form of retribution, punishment for our past karma? To repay our mistakes or to fulfill our life sentences? Thank you. Rebirth is like going to university. Failing the year and have to doing it all over again. That's what rebirth is like. If you learn your lessons, if you become wise, if you let go, you learn the Four Noble Truths, then you don't have to be reborn again. So, this time, please pass your exam. I've been working really hard to give you extra tutoring, even personal tutoring down in the library, at no extra cost, as well as the regular lectures twice a week. So you've got all this extra tutorial. Surely you must pass the exam in this lifetime. Dear Ajahn Brahm, whenever nightfall, people use to spray Ridsect or Mortain, as they are very scared that Ajahn mosquitoes might visit them. By doing so, is it considered breaking the precept or advice, please, Ajahn Brahm? Yes. Because there's other things you can use to repel mosquitoes without killing them. So use those things. Use mosquito nets. Or someone's put in my room some, what's it called? That stuff which smells the, it's not a killer, but it's just keeps the, what's it called? Yeah, to just like repel some mosses. But when they put it in my room, I said, are you sure I should do this? Aren't I being,
uncompassionate to mosquitoes by not giving them something to eat. But they put it in the room, not me, so that's okay. So it is actually, it is killing. So you can always find other ways of avoiding killing instead of actually spraying. Try and get mosquito screens in your house. Or, you know, try and use things which repel the mosquitoes rather than kill them. Or whatever. There's always some way, ways and means without really having to kill. Because once you get into killing pests, once you start to get to kill mosquitoes, the other things become your pests. And it's not that much from killing the pests, which are mosquitoes, to killing pests who are terrorists, killing pests who are your enemies, to killing a pest who's your husband. You've got to be careful. It starts with small things and ends in big things. Dilajan Brahm was a lay Buddhist, and I'm trying my best to keep the five precepts, but the fourth precept is often very difficult to keep. Lying. More often than not, when two persons get together, either they gossip or tell backbiting stories. Ajahn Brahm, you're enlightening a vast peace. That fourth precept means lying, deceiving another person, intentionally saying one thing, meaning another, or meaning to deceive them. If it's backbiting or gossip, that's breaking the right speech of the Eightfold Path, but it is not breaking your precepts. The precepts, Musawada, means telling a lie, which means deceiving somebody, saying you're going to meet them this evening but you deliberately don't go, saying that yes, you know, you're very happy to see them but really you hate them. It's lying. That's the fourth precept. So if you're gossiping, sort of telling backbiting stories, especially backbiting stories, it's not skillful, but it's not breaking the precepts. Lying is the precept. Usually it's the fifth precept people find hard to keep. The one about drinking. I already told yesterday about why we shouldn't drink, with the story of the man who got stopped at the police roadblock and stole the police car instead of his own car. Now sometimes it happens that people tell me in Australia, and I'm sure it's the same here in Malaysia, that in business, sometimes you have clients from overseas, and you want to sort of strike a deal. And they have cocktails, they have dinner, you have to have alcohol, they have a reception. Recently, when I was in Sydney, one of the disciples there told me, I don't know if I told this story, but I'm going to tell it anyway, that he had these clients, or this business people coming from Taiwan. They're about to sign a multi-million dollar business deal. And they just come from the final negotiations. This was a big deal for his company. When they came over, after a little bit of negotiations, they agreed to sign the contract. He got the contract. He got the deal. But then they said, we'll sign the deal this evening at a karaoke bar. You provide the alcohol. You provide the prostitutes. And that's when we'll sign the deal. And he said, look, I'm sorry, I don't drink. Number one, I don't take alcohol. Number two, I've got a wife. I love my wife, I'm faithful to her. No, I don't go with prostitutes. If you want to sign a deal, fine, but I don't want to do any of that. And the Taiwanese businessman said, listen, that's the way it's done. You do that, or there's no contract. He said, well, if that's the case, then there's no contract. And the Taiwanese walked out. He lost the contract because he was faithful to his wife, wanted to keep the third precept, and he wanted to keep the fifth precept of not taking alcohol. He lost the contract. That was how much he would sacrifice to keep his precepts. However, good always begets good. That evening, he received a phone call from the karaoke bar. The Taiwanese business people had talked it over. They said, it makes sense to us to do business with someone we can trust, someone who keeps moral virtues. We'd be around tomorrow to your office to sign the contract, which they did. He didn't need to bend his morality to suit someone else to get the contract. Doesn't it make sense to you? If you're a business person, would you rather sign a deal with someone who visits prostitutes and gets drunk when they're away from home, or to someone who's upstanding, moral, and trustworthy? obviously you'd sign a deal with someone who's trustworthy. If they can cheat on their wife, then they can cheat on you. So keeping those five precepts is good for business. However, one of the business people in Perth said, "Ajahn Brahm, I found it very difficult to keep those five precepts, especially the fifth precept of alcohol. Because when I would go to a reception, to a party, which I had to go to, because, you know, business is making relationships, then when the drinks would come round, I would say, 'No, thank you.' They would say, 'Why?' And I'd say, 'I don't drink because I'm a Buddhist.' They say, 'Let go.'" And he said it was so difficult that he ended up having to break his precept. So he had to think again. And he said he found a way of maintaining his precepts. He said the next time he went to a party, a reception or some dinner, when alcohol came round and someone gave him something to drink, he said, "Sorry, I can't, doctor's orders." When he told me this, I said, "Hang on, you're keeping that precept of not drinking, but aren't you lying? Aren't you breaking one precept to keep another? You've got no condition which your doctor told you you shouldn't take alcohol." And he smiled and he taught me some Buddhism. He said, "Ajahn Brahm, don't you remember your suttas? Didn't the Buddha often describe himself as a doctor? I'm not drinking because Dr. Buddha's orders." So if you're at a party or a business convention or whatever and you're offered a drink, if you say you're a Buddhist to a Westerner, then they probably won't accept it. But you say, "Doctor's orders, doctor's orders, I can only take an orange juice." And they would accept that. And you're not lying because it's Dr. Buddha's orders. "Good evening, Ajahn Brahm." My goodness, it's hard to read. "When we do the prostration, is there any reason it has to be 5 points? Thank you." Now that's just a tradition. The most important thing is you do it gracefully, you lower your head. Some people, you know, because of some injury or because they're too fat, they can't bow down on the ground. So they do whatever they can. Traditionally it was the 5-point prostration in the time of the Buddha. But you do whatever you can. Do it gracefully, but do it meaningfully as well. Don't do it just with your body, do it with your heart. Okay? "Dear Ajahn, even though Buddhists are not necessarily vegetarians, there are 10 types of forbidden meat, such as horse, tiger, bear, etc., which should not be consumed. Why is this so?" It's interesting, they say that these are like higher animals, and these are animals which often live in the jungles, and especially forest monks, they say if you eat like snake meat, you're liable to get bitten by a snake. If you eat tiger meat, you're liable to be eaten by a tiger. If you eat bear meat, they'll sometimes smell that and attack you. So I was told as a young monk, especially by other forest monks, that one of the reasons why those were forbidden meats for monks was because that there'd be some karmic retribution there. Even though you didn't kill that bear, the bear would smell that you've eaten bear meat and would attack you. So I don't know if that's true or not, if there's anything physiological there, but that's what I was told. Other than that, I don't know. "Dear Ajahn, what's the wise way of getting rid of anger and hatred when we see people who have hurt us emotionally or whose behavior are not to our liking, who are not morally correct?" Okay, I mentioned the story, I think a couple of days ago, of the husband who went to the market to get the eggs, who was abused by the mad person in the market. You all remember that story, don't you? And because he was a crazy person, when that crazy person hurt him or abused him or scolded him or whose behavior was not to the husband's liking, it didn't matter at all because the guy was crazy. The wise way of getting rid of anger and hatred when we see people who have hurt us is to remember they did that out of temporary insanity. They were crazy when they hurt you. They are stupid not to be moral. So you can actually look upon them as being insane to do something like that to you. Number two, because no one would hurt another person if they were wise. It just does not make sense. Why do we hurt other people?
Why do you hurt other people? Often it's because you're hurting yourself. You're hurting, and so you get crazy, and you hurt other people. So realize where it's coming from. Sometimes people get crazy at traffic lights and destroy them. They get anger. It's not the traffic light's fault. If someone gets angry at you, it's like getting angry at traffic light. Have you got angry at your computer when it's crashed and you really want it to work? I remember one monk, he was sewing a robe and the needle kept on breaking. And I saw him in a monastery sort of hitting that sewing machine. You stupid sewing machine, you stupid sewing machine. It wasn't the sewing machine's fault. Sewing machines aren't intelligent or stupid. They haven't got a mind. They haven't got five khandhas. It's just a sewing machine, that's all. We can hate a sewing machine and take it out of them. Just like someone can take it out on you. You've done nothing at all. It's not your fault. Remember that when you get abused, because sometimes we take it personally. We say, what have I done to deserve that? Answer, nothing. It's their problem. They are angry and upset. So the compassion should go to them. Poor things. They're crazy, they're mad, they're hurting themselves. Their karma will catch up on them. If they have hurt, abused you, if they have been morally incorrect, then if they're a Buddhist, they'll have to be punished by karma. If they're a Hindu, they'll be punished by karma. If they're a Christian, they'll be punished by God. If by Muslim, by Allah. And you know, if they're an atheist, because of their moral anger, hatred, immorality, anger and hatred, if they hurt somebody, if they're an atheist, they will have to go into therapy for many years. And that's very expensive and time consuming. So no one escapes the consequences of their actions. So if they've hurt you, if they've acted irresponsibly, if they've been bad, you do not need to punish them. Punishment will come to them automatically. You don't need to get involved. In particular, I've got a very quick saying, I never allow anyone to control my happiness. If someone gets angry at me, why should I become unhappy because of what they say? They can call me what they like, but I am not going to get unhappy. They can even hit me, but I am not going to get unhappy. Why should I allow them to control my happiness and make me upset? I refuse to get upset. The girls can call me Ajahn Brah, and I just laugh. I refuse to get upset. So, this is the wise way. When someone does something wrong, you don't allow them to steal your happiness by getting angry. You don't allow them to steal your peace by you hating them. Your peace, your happiness is your concern. You maintain that peace and happiness no matter what another person does. Next question. Dear Ajahn, can women be reborn as men? Yes. Why do you want to be reborn as a man? Ask the men, so what's it like being a man? Do the men want to be reborn as women? Now, if the woman wants to be reborn as a monk, or the men reborn as a monk, to say, yeah, that's a good thing to do. No, it's that women can be reborn as... I didn't mention this. Why do women get reborn as men? Why do men get reborn as women? Why do people get reborn as this or that? Because we want to. It's our aspiration, our desire. Now, some people in Asia years ago, they just wanted to get reborn in the West. Some of the Westerners wanted to get reborn in Asia because they didn't like the West. It's our fantasies, our dreams. We want to be reborn in a place where we can fulfill our hopes and our dreams. So a lot of times we get reborn as a man because we think a man's life is wonderful. We get reborn as a woman because we think a woman's life is wonderful. As I said to you, that some of my disciples, the stupid ones in Perth, want to get reborn as a cat. So they don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. And they just get fed and petted, looked after. They can stay in a warm house all day. They can go out, do whatever they want. They don't have to go to school. In life, we need to do a lot of decisions. If we just don't know what to do, how to decide what we should do. Where do you have to make a decision in life? It's like coming to the crossroads in life. You know that, they always use that simile. You come to the crossroads in life. You can go in four directions. Which direction should you go in? My advice is when you come to the crossroads in life, sit down and wait for the bus. Sit down and wait for the bus. What that really means, because sooner or later a bus will come. And that bus, in all parts of the world, it has its destination written on the front. It tells you where it's going. So you wait for the bus, and when you see the destination written on the front, if that's where you want to go, get on that bus. If you don't want to go there, there's always another bus coming behind. Always another opportunity. What that simply means, that if you don't know what to do, wait. Don't make rash decisions. If you've got the time, wait. After a while, information, experience, knowledge will come. And if that knowledge tells you that, yes, this is the way I want to go, then you take that bus. If you haven't got enough information yet, you wait for some more information to come. If you've got a crossroads in life, sit at the crossroads, wait for the bus. Should I change my job? Should I not change my job? Should I change my husband, not change my husband? Sit at the crossroads and wait. What you do, you program all that information in. Find out as much information as you can. Get all the bus timetables, all the information. And then programming it into your mind. And then forget about it. Wait. After a day or two, the right decision will always come up. It will feel good. You know this is the right decision. When you put all the information in, put it into your computer mind, then wait. And after a while, just the answer comes out. You say, oh, this is what I've got to do. It feels right. And it will be right. Ajahn. That night, somebody asked about writing of a Buddhist obituary, and you said, write from the heart, write from the book. How about the one below? May you have the opportunity to learn, practice, and realize the ultimate truth until you're enlightened. May you be well and happy. Is this acceptable? Sounds okay to me, but as long as it came from the heart and not from the computer. Because sometimes you can do that. You can press in obituaries and get all other obituaries which other people have thought about. You can get some advice, but find the one out for yourself. The obituary, it's nice if it's something more personal than that. Something which applies to that one person which you can never give to anybody else. That's a really nice obituary. If a monk disrobed because of the opposite sex, will the opposite sex get bad karma? If it was their intention to disrobe that monk, yes, they do. Thank you. But also, it's the monk's fault. It's not just the woman's fault. It takes two to tango, as they say. It's the monk's bad karma as well. Because sometimes, there's this story, and this is a true story of one of my friends who was a monk, an Australian, ordained in Burma. He came to Melbourne. And while he was staying in Melbourne, there was an Indonesian girl from an extremely wealthy family. Her father was just, you know, one of these big multimillionaires, and so she just had so much money herself. So she looked like she took a fancy to him. He was willing. They talked about it. They decided that they'd fallen in love. They will get this robe. He will get this robe, and he would marry her. So he left the temple in Melbourne. He went to a hotel with her. Rang up somebody to say he's disrobing and spent the night with her. After spending the night with her, having got disrobed, she said, thank you very much, bye-bye. And she left him in the hotel. He was completely fooled by that woman. She just disrobed him just for basically just something to do. So a rich, spoiled girl. And this poor monk lost his monkhood just for like a one-night stand. From a woman who never really loved him, who just was doing this just for a bit of teasing, pleasure, fun. But it was really good for him, because he went straight back to the temple the next day and said, I've been a fool, I've been stupid. And everybody respected him for being honest. Sometimes monks describe they're not honest.
Let's say I disrobe because of bad health. It's not bad health, it's a disease of lust. So that girl certainly got very bad karma for how she behaved. Sometimes, and if it's not really intentional, sometimes, like if a woman sort of really likes a monk, or the monk makes the advances, which he shouldn't do. There are some rules, which you should know, it's an interesting rule list, and many of you have seen this rule, the way when I conduct interviews, one of the rules for monks is we should never be alone with another woman. There should always be a man there who understands the sense of what's being said, like a chaperone. Because if, for example, I had interviews down in that library there, just by myself, alone with you, who would know what went on in there? Who would know what was being said? And sooner or later, someone will come along and say, Ajahn Brahm, you spent half an hour with her, you only spent 10 minutes with me. What were you doing? Even though it was quite, you know, natural that, you know, she had more problems or something, who knows? So because of that, what we call the suspicions of the malicious, we always make sure there's another person there, which actually helps both parties. It means the woman is safe from any criticism, and so is the monk. It's all above board. And if monks kept that rule, and you help monks keep that rule, there'd be very, very few monks disrobing. They would have the opportunity, because there'd always be a monk there, or another man there, to keep everyone honest. So we keep that rule very, very strictly in our monastery. That's why I don't have many monks disrobing. Good evening, Ajahn. Can I say that all yogis' 8 preceptors will not suffer from HIV, AIDS and other related sexually transmitted diseases? If they fully observe the 8 precepts, can they also avoid contracting highly infectious diseases like SARS, BSE, Asian flu, etc., which are increasing in the world today? Obviously, if you keep 8 precepts, you can't get a sexually transmitted disease. But even if you keep your 5 precepts, you know, keep to your wife, your husband, the chances of you getting one of those sexually transmitted diseases are very, very low, obviously. Now, like everyone has to keep some sort of celibacy, some sort of restraint. For monks, it's complete restraint. If you're married, you've got a partner, you may see someone else you really like, but you have to say no. They say the pleasure is outweighed by the problems and troubles it causes afterwards. So when you see the big picture, not just the pleasure of the moment, but the big picture, you say, no, no, I'm not going to break my marriage vows. You might see someone, you might have a steamy affair for a few nights, but is it really worth it? The answer is no. So just be honest, be straight up with the causes and effects. But if you keep the 8 precepts, can you also avoid contracting some of the other diseases? Now, people with 8 precepts still get diseases, because if you have a body, you're going to get diseases from time to time. But the best way of avoiding those diseases is to create happiness in your life. Through your meditation, or you keep precepts, it does increase your average happiness. If you meditate, not the anapanasati way, but the anapanasati way, then you get more happy, and that increases your immune system. If you manage to lessen your stress, the chances of you getting diseases are less. During the SARS crisis, I was due to give a series of talks in Singapore. The government suggested that no one should go to public gatherings. The Buddhist Fellowship were wondering, should we cancel or not? I said, no. Tell everyone to come to Ajahn Brahm's talks, because I'm going to make you laugh. When you laugh, you're exercising your lungs. The chance of respiratory illness are much less. Moreover, you are going to get happy. You're going to get less stress. And we know that getting happy, having less stress, increases your immune system. You'll become more resistant to SARS. So I think the first day was in Suntec, 1,800 people come, it went up to 2,000, finished up 2,500. I think in 5 days, averaging about 2,200 people every talk. And not one of them got SARS. See what happens? Because you know what happened? I told people, listen. It was in the papers. I saw the paper that morning. 99 people had SARS, it said, that morning. And I said, how many is the population of Singapore? And it was about 3 million. So I announced, I said, this morning, 2,999,901 people haven't got SARS today. When we say how many people have got SARS, we get worried. When we say only 99 people have got SARS, 2,999,901 people haven't got SARS, it puts things in perspective, doesn't it? So they all went to the talk and none of them got SARS. So I increased their immune system by making them laugh. So that's the best way to stop having contracting highly infectious diseases like SARS, BSC, Asian flu. It is to laugh. Be light, lessen your stress levels by meditating, keeping precepts. Next question. Do heavenly beings practice Dharma like human beings? Thank you very much. Some do, some don't. There was one of my stories. Heavenly beings, do devas practice Dharma? Do some not? I told you yesterday about devas doing dana, how they helped that the young American become a monk, how they gave food to this famous time monk walking through the jungle, and how they gave 9 bottles of Pepsi to a young Western monk. So devas sometimes do dana. And sometimes they can practice meditation as well, but it's very, very rare because they're having too good a time. There was a story in the suttas of Gopika. Gopika was Upasika, was a disciple, devoted disciple of the Buddha. And one day, 2 monks turned up in her village. They wanted to spend the rains close by. She invited them to stay the rains. She took them to a lovely spot by the river. And she fed them herself every day. She gave them dana. She cleaned up their residence. She did everything for these 2 monks, so they didn't have anything to do at all except meditate, practice Dharma. Even though it meant extra work for her, she didn't have any time for her own practice. She worked so hard for these 2 monks. When she died, she got reborn in the heaven of the 33, along with Sakka. When she was reborn, she remembered these 2 monks. She wondered where they'd been reborn. They got reborn 2 realms lower than her, in the realm of the Gandavas. She was so upset. She went to scold those monks. She said, I cooked for you, I washed for you, I looked after you. What were you monks doing all that rains retreat? Look, I've been reborn in a better place than you have, you lazy, non-for-good monks. She really gave them a scolding. And they deserved it. Because they'd obviously been wasting their time. Their attainments were less than hers. And when she scolded them, one of them completely ignored her. He stayed where he was. The other one remembered those teachings. And just remembering those teachings, almost immediately, he was reborn as an anagami, a non-returner, in the Sudarvasa. It's a case of one of the monks, because they were scolded, got reborn, got an attainment of enlightenment in the Deva realms. It's possible, but it doesn't happen all that often. The best place to practice is here and now. You have the opportunity, you have the time. Many of you yogis think the retreat's going to end soon. Who knows? The future is uncertain. There's a story, I was going to tell it tomorrow, maybe I'll tell it tonight. There's a story of a friend of mine, a New Zealander, who became a monk in the Korean tradition. In the Korean tradition, every year they have a monastic retreat. But it's not a soft retreat like this one. It makes even Vipassana retreats look really soft and easy. This was a 60-day, 2-month retreat. 3 o'clock in the morning, you wake up. Can't go to the bathroom. As soon as you wake up, sit meditation. Because you go to sleep where you meditate. Like going to sleep right there where you're sitting now. 3 o'clock, you wake up. 50 minutes sitting, 10 minutes walking, all together, according to the bell. The only respite is your 1 meal a day, which you eat
in the place where you're sitting. You can't stretch your legs except when you're walking. You can have a toilet break, and the only other thing you can do is go and see the master for the interview. But that's even worse than the pain. He scolds you. He's fierce. And about 10 o'clock, you can go to bed. You can rest where you are. Meditating so intensively, even after the first day of his first retreat, this monk was in great pain. His legs were aching, his back was aching, and there was no go and take a snooze like Ajahn Brahm tells you. He wondered whether a Westerner could endure such an intense 60 days meditation retreat. On that first night, his body was aching all over. As soon as he lay down, it was as if the bell for 3 o'clock went. The sleep was too short, and he had to start all over again for another day. After 3 days, it was torture. He didn't know how he could handle this any longer, but he looked around and saw all his other Korean monks sitting dead straight. His national pride took over. He thought, if they can do it, so can I. His pride took him to the end of the first week, when he thought he should run away. It was hurting that much. I mean, real pain, hour after hour, ache, 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 pain, 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 with no respite. But he thought, he'd done 1 week, let's try another week. That's what it was like. Many times he felt like crying, because the pain was so intense. Just moment by moment, he just endured, he pushed through. He said the watershed was when he completed the 30 days, the first month. It was halfway. He wasn't going to give in now. To run away now, even though the pain was intense, would be like unfaithful to all the effort he'd been putting in so far. That last month stretched out like infinity. Days and days were like burning, and the only respite was to go and see the master, who was so strict with him. The abbot was really fierce. It came to only 2 weeks to go. 1 week to go, he could see the light at the end of the tunnel. But that last week stretched like an eon. Every day seemed to be so long and so much agony. But then came the last day. When that bell came for the last day, like tomorrow, your last day here, he woke up thinking, ah, the last day. It doesn't matter how much pain it is. There's only got a few hours to go. 50 minutes of sitting, 10 minutes of walking. When it got to his last sit, the last 50 minutes, he started to think, only 50 minutes to go. And he started dreaming of the hot bath he was going to have, the nice food he was going to have. You can choose your own food tomorrow. You can go and watch the TV. You can sit down in a comfortable chair in your own home again. You can go to bed in this lovely bed, not on the floor with all these other snoring yogis. You can get a good night's sleep. He started thinking about that, but immediately he started thinking about that. The pain just burst in. It was so strong. That last 50 minutes was the most intense pain he's ever had. He thought he was going to die before the 50 minutes was finished. Every now and again he'd sneak a look at the clock. Surely that was almost 50 minutes, only 5. Surely another hour, only 10 minutes gone past. He became convinced that the batteries in the clock had run down and when the clock was going slow. He got afraid that the batteries might dry off already and the clock might stop 5 minutes before the end of the retreat, sticking him forever in that painful posture. Fantasies and dreams like that came up. It was the longest 50 minutes in his whole life, he said. But everything comes to an end. And he heard the sweetest sound when the abbot rang the gong. The last sitting of the 60-day intense retreat. He said all his pain disappeared then, because he knew it was over. And they're all about to bow when the abbot rang his bell a second time. Before you go, he said, I have an announcement to make. This has been one of the best retreats ever. Many people have got such deep meditation. They found it so useful that a couple of you monks have asked we continue this retreat for another fortnight. I've been considering this and I think it's a wonderful idea. Cross your legs, carry on sitting. We're going on for another 2 weeks. Oh, this New Zealander. He had to cross his legs again, but he told me he never felt any pain. Because he was trying to find out who these two damn monks were. And he started thinking all the terrible tortures he was going to do to these two monks. He was so angry. He was murderous. The sort of thoughts he was thinking, well, no monk should think like that. But he was. And then the bell went again. About 15 minutes had gone past in a flash as he was angry with all his murderous thoughts. The bell went again. He opened his eyes, confused. The abbot smiled and said, "Retreat over. There's refreshments down in the dining room. There's a hot bath for you all. Relax. The retreat's over." And he said, "What's going on? Are we carrying on? Are we not carrying on? What's happening?" He was so confused. And one of the other monks, one of the senior monks, came up to him and said in English, "That abbot, he does the same thing every year." Now that really taught that young monk. He said he learned more in that 15 minutes than in all the 60 days. He learned that expectation causes pain. If you expect the retreat to finish tomorrow afternoon, I have an announcement for you. The future's uncertain. We do not know. Okay. I'll get you all worried now. I was told that if we hate someone in this life, he or she will be the one we crave for in our next life. Is this true? Please correct my wrong understandings. No, not usually. If you hate someone in this life, you usually hate them in the next life as well. Usually what happens. Until you get wise, you don't hate anybody. Hating someone else is only hating your own happiness. Not allowing yourself to be at peace. Oh, a long one here. In monotheistic religions, there is a belief in the creation of life wherein, when a child is conceived, a life has been created by God. In Buddhism, is there such a thing as the creation of life in one of the 32 planes of existence? Or is the almost infinite number of beings in all planes of existence always remains a constant throughout time, including the number of beings that achieve enlightenment? When a person becomes enlightened after death, does it mean that the person being will cease from all existence due to no more rebirth, as if the being was never created or existed before, or is the enlightened person state after death is far beyond my comprehension as stated above? Please correct me if I'm wrong. Sorry for the long question. It's good job I'm a compassionate monk who always forgives. Yeah, there's no beings created by a god, because the god is a being must also be created. So every being in this universe comes from a past, is not created, doesn't suddenly come in from existence or come in from nothing. It evolves. It's interesting, the Buddha does say somewhere that even the plants and the trees will someday evolve into being five tender beings and take their place in samsara. It's just an evolution of life forms of consciousness. And so when some beings come out of this world by becoming enlightened, there's plenty of other sources for new beings, not being created by a god, but evolving according to natural processes. So the number of beings in this universe is infinite and always will be so. Which is why in Mahayana sometimes people say that they will put off their enlightenment until every last blade of grass is enlightened. Which is one of the reasons why Buddhists should not grow gardens. You're just making more grass and putting off the Bodhisattva's enlightenment for many more eons. Do you understand that? They say, "I'm going to put off my enlightenment until every blade of grass is enlightenment." And somebody makes more grass. So that makes the Bodhisattva's job even longer. So if you're a Buddhist, please don't grow any grass. You're giving the Bodhisattvas more work to do. So, when you do become enlightened, do you go into nothingness? Or is it a state beyond your comprehension? Now you have to know what anatta is before you'll understand that, but it's much closer to disappearing out of existence than going to some place. But if you don't understand that, it doesn't matter, because you can't understand nirvana until you understand anatta first. So get that one down first of all. Find out who it is you take yourself to be. Who is this person who you think is you? Once you understand that one, then you'll understand the answer to the question, what is nirvana? Just like the frog will never be able to answer the question, what is dry land, until they get out of dry land. A frog would never understand what water is. If a monk smokes, is he virtuous? No, if a monk smokes, he is on fire. What a stupid thing to do. No, to stick dry grass in your mouth and set fire to it. That's what smoking is. So, are you virtuous? It's not against the precepts. However, in the olden days, no one knew, or at least the monks never knew, or most people didn't know that smoking is bad for your health. It creates cancer. It's not just bad for your health, it's terrible for your health. And it's also terrible for other people's health. Apparently, the passive smoking is much, much worse than people thought. That kills many people as well. So smoking, not just killing yourself, you're killing your friends as well, and your relations. So when you look at it that way, that it doesn't make any sense for anyone to smoke. Least of all, a monk. A monk is supposed to be giving up things, restraining themselves. So I think if you see monks smoking, that's very, very sad. They should really give up smoking. If they can't give up smoking, what can they give up? If they can't give up stomach, which is obviously going to kill them, how can they give up other things as well? So if I see a monk smoking, it's really, really disappointing. I think that the sanghas of such places like Thailand and Burma and other places should make it a law and rule. No monk should smoke. If they get smoked, it should be some sort of punishment or something. 50 strokes of the cat. Or something to actually stop them smoking. How does one tell their parents that she is a lesbian? Thank you. Remind your parents about loving kindness. That doesn't matter who you are or what you are, that you are their daughter, their child. And so they can love you for who you are. Not for what they want you to be. It'd be wonderful if people had that loving kindness and could accept their children if they're gay or if they're lesbian. It doesn't matter, according to the precepts. Being a lesbian does not break the five precepts. Being gay does not break the five precepts. It's how you are gay, or how you're lesbian, or how you're heterosexual, means whether you break the precepts or not. If you're a lesbian in a homosexual relationship with another woman, and it's a caring, loving, committed relationship, then I can't see any difference between a heterosexual relationship, which is also caring and loving and committed. However, if you're in a lesbian relationship and you go in with another woman, you sleep around, then that's as bad. That is breaking your precepts. That is not trusting the partner you've committed to. In the same way, if you're in a heterosexual relationship and you go sleeping with someone else, having an affair with someone else, that is breaking your precepts. So it really doesn't matter whether it's a homosexual or heterosexual relationship. It's how you live that relationship. Depends, means whether you are breaking your precepts or not. There are many homosexual men in our Buddhist society, Buddhist community in Perth. They are well-valued Buddhists. They're good meditators. They help, they serve, they do dharma. They're basically good people. Now, I wasn't a homosexual myself before I was a monk. I was a heterosexual. I had girlfriends, not boyfriends. I never knew anything about homosexuals. But when I became a monk, when I went to the West, when you're faced with that problem, you had to understand it, deal with it, face it, not with fear. So I talked to some of those homosexuals, got to know them as friends, as disciples, heard their problems, listened to them, opened my heart compassionately. And when you see the pain and the fear they go through, I was got so much compassion and care for them that I welcomed them into our Buddhist society, gave them a home in the Buddhist community, did not try and reject them because of their sexual orientation, no more than I would reject anyone because they were an Asian, African, Aboriginal or whatever. Their gender, sexual orientation, even if they were Christian, they were welcome. I don't care who you are. The door of my heart is open to all beings, no matter who they are. That's what compassion really is, loving kindness truly is. So hopefully, whoever wrote that question, if your parents are really Buddhist, I hope that you can really feel confident they will understand. They will open their heart to you. And they will give you the support which you need. They will understand, support, say, listen, I don't care whether you're a lesbian, whether you are homosexual, whether you're heterosexual or what you are. You're my child. I care for you. I want you to be happy. If that's the way you want to be happy, you're not harming others, you're not harming yourself, then I will stand behind you and help you. I will love you for who you are, not trying to change you. So that's what I would say. Hopefully your parents can be accepting and could be really good Buddhists and be compassionate. The underlying principle to morality in Buddhism is, does it hurt anybody? Does it hurt yourself? Does it hurt others? If you can locate any hurt or harm a loving, committed homosexual relationship does, then please tell me and I'll say, yes, okay, it is immoral. But I've never seen that. I've seen a good relationship only doing good in the world. And as such, I can't see it's breaking any precept. Next question. What needs to be done if a precept is broken? Does he, she have to retake the precepts in the presence of the Sangha? If a precept is broken, acknowledge, forgive, learn. Know you've broken your precept. If there's a monk around, great. You know, take the precept from a monk or from a nun. If there's no monk around, go in front of a Buddha statue, bow 3 times, and redetermine your 5 precepts. You don't need a monk, but it does help to have some sort of figure in front of you to make a resolution more firm psychologically. Last question. Actually, it's not the last question of this retreat because we're going another 2 weeks, aren't we? Maybe it's the last question, but who knows? How does the karma of this life or previous life affect the next life? If we say the 5 aggregates affected by clinging ceases upon cessation of this life, are we saying there's something that provides contact for 2 instances for karma to work? Kind of lightness. Okay, karma is a process. Karma is what I said yesterday, of resonating from the past. So it's not stored in the 5 khandhas. It's not stored in the body. It's not stored in the mind. We do karma from the past. So we do karma in the past, and that is a potential waiting to contact us at any time. When we are ripe, we are resonant, the situation is just right, then the karma from the past will resonate with us and that karma will reach us, just like memory. Karma and memory are very close together. That's why our memory from a past life, where is that stored? It's stored nowhere. The memories from a past life can't be stored anywhere. How can they? It's a completely different time, different body. But we can still remember that past. When we remember a past, we also connect with the karma. The same way that memory happens. I'm talking about past life memories, underlying memories. That same process is a conduit for karma from the past to affect our present. Okay. I think that's enough for this evening. So I hope you enjoyed to talk about rebirth and some of the questions which come afterwards. Actually, there is another day of questions, isn't it? Because we've got another talk tomorrow night. Now you've heard about reincarnation, rebirth. So you don't have to get reborn again and be like that young boy who said when he was born, "Oh no, not again." So come tomorrow night to see how you can stop rebirth. So you never have to say, "Oh no, not again." So you don't have to wear nappies again. You don't have to go to school again. If you come tomorrow night and listen to why not you, or how to put Buddhism into your daily life. That's right, isn't it? Living the Dharma tomorrow night. Please bring all your friends. And remember, all your enemies as well. They need to hear it more than your friends. Thank you for coming. Any announcements? Okay, so please go peacefully. See you tomorrow night for the last talk, the big one. Yeah? Oh, sharing of merits, yeah. So now, hang on, shh. Sharing of merits. Idam men yati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam men yati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idame yatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Now you can do it. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.